Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. Six South African male medical doctors on a mission. South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive healthcare. Today, joining us in the studio is our esteemed guest, Dr. Brad Merwitz, who is an endocrinologist currently working in private. Today, we're going to be discussing a lot of things, all man and hormone related. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode. As always, we're going to start by welcoming our guest. Welcome, Dr. Brad Merwitz.
Thank you very much.
Brad, so normally how our episodes work is whenever you have a doctor on the podcast, we ask them to give us an interesting story for the week. So tell us an interesting story either from your medical school career, specializing, anywhere in your career. Tell us the most interesting case you've ever had.
Well, I think something that stands out to me, yeah. I don't know if it's the most interesting, but stands out to me of something presenting in an odd way. There was once a gentleman that I was involved with when I was still working at Joburg Gen, and he came in complaining of a severe headache. Uh-huh. So he was admitted, he was worked up, diagnosed with meningitis, and so his antibiotics were started, and after 1 day, 2 days, he wasn't getting better. Mm. All of a sudden, his whole condition changed, and he started to fluctuate. His blood pressure was down. We scanned him, because it's a challenge to get a scan. We got a scan, and he'd had a pituitary apoplexy, bled into his pituitary, and he had a silent tumor over there.
Wow.
And so from the endocrine side, it became a very exciting and interesting case, because here was this guy manifesting as a meningitis, but with hypopituitarism. And of course, he was rushed off for emergency neurosurgery. And we saved his life, which is always nice in endocrinology, because you don't always get that immediate kind of thing. He did exceptionally well, and in fact, it was a rare presentation. So we actually managed to write him up for a journal, and he's done fantastically well.
Wow!
It's just something to think of, you know, uncommon conditions, but presenting with common ways, you know.
Yes, it's just
always made me think that sometimes we need to take a slightly different look at things.
Very interesting. You know, normally we have these sensational stories. We've had him talk about gunshot penises and penis transplants. So it's interesting to also hear that people still care about saving lives. So that's always great. So today's topic for discussion, we're going to be talking, men, their hormones, health, and some of obviously advice that you can give to men to optimize themselves from a hormonal standpoint, because for those of you who don't know, endocrinologists deal with all hormone-related issues. Is that a fair way?
Yeah.
So that's essentially what Dr. Merwitz does. And firstly, I just want to know, how did you get into endocrinology, and what's your career been like? Why did you choose to go down this path?
So I'll always tell people, I chose endocrinology because heart attacks don't keep office hours. So cardiology wasn't for me. But the truth of the matter is, I thought I'd start off medical school. When I started off, I thought I'd be a plastic surgeon.
Okay.
Yeah. Didn't know much about medicine or plastic surgery, but I thought it would be a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
And in our first year of clinical medicine in fourth year, I had a colleague, he was a friend of mine, and he said, you know, when you do your first internal medicine rotation, you're going to love it. Mm-hmm. And he was right. I did internal medicine. I knew that was what I was going to do, to be a physician. And within the registrar time, you do your rotations through the various subspecialties. And I've always had an affinity for endocrinology. And I hated diabetes.
Oh, okay.
Hated it.
And hated it as in you hated studying it, or hated it as in...
Treating it,
okay.
The clinic, I just didn't enjoy it. And when I did an endocrinology rotation, I was exposed to a fellow at the time, a colleague, and he just gave me a different way of looking at it, and it changed everything, and then that was it for me, endocrinology as well.
Who's the colleague? Maybe we know him.
Dr. Sandeep Ruda.
Oh, okay.
So Sandeep works at Four Ways Life.
Okay, and, yes, I do remember him. He actually spoke at our graduation.
He would have done.
At
the graduation breakfast,
one at Melrose Arch.
I remember him. He used to give us tats really.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
So he gave me a different way of looking at diabetes, and it was just something that I really, really enjoyed. And I enjoy the puzzle solving of endocrinology, you know, data interpretation, looking at the results. And I'm not an adrenaline junkie, so for me to do the ICU time and intubations, not my thing.
Okay.
So you do the internal medicine for 4 years, and then it was a 3-year fellowship thereafter, all done on the WITS circuit.
So you studied at WITS,
undergraduate
WITS, postgrad, everything you've done at WITS.
Yeah, just my internship was at Pretoria. in Pretoria Academic Hospital, which is now Tshwane District.
Okay.
And community service at Natalspruit, but the rest of the time has been at Wits.
Awesome, awesome. Okay, so now at least we have an understanding of who you are, where you came from. First on the agenda, Nas, let's get the conversation going.
So, like, you normally see patients at the Jens Clinic, people say they have low libido, low drive, they're feeling weak and tired. Then you think about all the things that can cause low energy, something like feeling like just a constant level of fatigue. Then when you think about it on an endocrinological kind of view, it's a lot of different diagnoses.
Yeah.
So initially they come to us thinking that they probably have low testosterone, and it could be a thing. But it could be other things. It could be diabetes, thyroid. Maybe you can talk about like low energy and what else that could be.
So it's interesting. Worldwide, fatigue is one of the commonest presenting complaints to doctors.
Yeah.
Mm. And many people, their instinct is to say, it must be thyroid.
Yeah.
You know. But we find that still the commonest cause is actually poor sleep.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because poor sleeping habits will directly plug into endocrinology, because if you're not sleeping well, nothing's going to be optimized. Mm. But once you go past it, so obviously the history becomes very important. How are you sleeping? What is your diet like? How much exercise are you doing? What's your stress level? All that becomes important. And assuming there's not too much to tease out of that, then we will start to look at the hormones. And the common things, as they always say, common things occur commonly. So thyroid and testosterone in men, those are probably the two most common things to look at. And of course, there'll be some other clues maybe in the blood work that can point towards testosterone or thyroid, but ultimately if you've got an index of suspicion, you'll test for those. And you know, my professor always said to me, when you've got a young man complaining of fatigue, check iron levels, because high ferritin and hemochromatosis is common. Mm. And that can cause hypogonadism as well. Yeah. So these are things we think of. And I would generally say if you've got a gent who's doesn't really matter the age, but particularly young guys, you check the thyroid, you check the testosterone, check the full blood count and the iron. That's a good starting point for them. And then you guard it by those.
I like that you started with lifestyle, good sleep, diet. That usually is stuff that we ignore a lot of the time, right? So what are the normal things that you normally see in terms of diet and lifestyle that people are doing that are like usually causing diabetes, low energy, those kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, firstly, calorie intake is one thing. We've got an abundance of calories, but it's all poor quality food.
Yeah.
So a lot of fast food, takeout, you know, sugar sweetened beverages, very calorie dense and nutritionally poor foods. And people also more and more are losing the ability to discern what's enough. Mm. You know, we get these giant plates, giant portions now, and we have a good way. We're able to train ourselves to not feel full anymore. So when you're looking at diet, it's just poor quality nutrition. And as much as we think instinctively we should know what's healthy food, many people don't. You don't think about it. You're working late hours. You're going to grab a Coke. Anecdotally, I remember Saturday nights driving into Barrack Wellness Hospital for a call. I got a giant bar wine and a giant Red Bull. Now, that was for a short period of time, but many people, that's their staple.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to look at the quality of the nutrition. That's the major, major part. Sugar-sweetened beverages as well. Yeah. You can cut out the Coke. You can already do some good work over there. And then, of course, sedentary lifestyle. Yeah. You know, we're more and more finding ourselves in professions where we're seated for a lot of the day, and sitting is the new smoking, you know, in terms of its deleterious effects on health and outcomes. They say for every hour you sit, you should get up and walk around.
Yeah.
A lot of times we're not doing that. Exercise, people always find an excuse not to exercise. Mm. And these are the things that we have to address. Even if a person is going to go into some form of therapy, they're not going to derive the full benefit if they're not optimizing their lifestyle. So that's always a starting point.
Yeah. Especially also with diabetes. So people think, I'm eating food, right? Like what food are you eating? Biscuits, like heavy starch, bread, Coke. And they have no idea that, look, your food is actually, the quality matters. I learned that from Suhail also. Like Suhail will tell me, he eats a lot, but good quality food. And he's healthy that way.
I think a good piece of advice to give a patient or someone that you're talking with, when they look in the ingredients, if the ingredients are anything other than food, it's probably not a good thing to eat. Meaning, if it's chemicals you can't pronounce, if the first ingredient is sugar, if it's all additives and it's this refined flour and that kind of starch, it's poor quality food. And that's something to reduce or avoid if possible.
Yeah. And another thing for, like, I want to take it personally. Like, for me, I struggle with cortisol, right? Mm. So we work in ED, work over hours, after hours, like overnights, 24 hours, right? So you have a high level of just chronic stress, right? And we're just having all this like adrenaline all the time. Then our sleep cycle gets messed up and all of this. do you see like adrenal fatigue kind of thing? Do you see kind of that kind of
issues? Sorry to interrupt. Before you give the answer, yeah, just for the viewers, if they could understand what you mean by circadian rhythm, cortisol, the stress response, and then adrenal fatigue.
Yeah, so you have like an adrenal gland, right? It's a gland on top of your kidney that produce like mineralocorticoids, also some testosterone, right? And also like some of your energy, like metabolism kind of thing, and also cortisol. And cortisol is like a sort of stress hormone that gives you like a fight or flight kind of response in your body. It helps also with the metabolism as well.
So cortisol is absolutely essential for survival. People with Addison's disease or some other cause of non-functioning adrenal glands can't survive. But like anything, if it's in excess, it's bad. And so the classical condition we speak of when there's high levels of cortisol is Cushing's syndrome, which is any cause of elevated cortisol, whether someone is taking cortisone for an upper respiratory tract infection or asthma or an autoimmune condition, sometimes it's in cream or a gel, whatever it might be. That's the commonest cause. And then we get endogenous causes of Cushing's syndrome, the commonest being Cushing's disease, which is a small tumor in the pituitary gland that causes an oversecretion of cortisol ultimately. That's a relatively rare condition. But what we see with a lot of people is that they lead extremely stressful lifestyles. And so there may be an elevated basal level of cortisol. When we do the tests, it doesn't flag as necessarily being in the pathological range. And so there's not much that we do about it. But what we do know is important is when people are not sleeping well, are not eating well, are not exercising, they lose their circadian rhythms. Now, what that means is that we have a bio clock that allows hormones to be secreted in different concentrations at different times of the day. So for example, cortisol is mostly secreted from about 4 to 6 a.m. in the morning, reaching a peak at about 8.
Wake you up.
Yeah, absolutely. To wake you up. And it's not something you want to have high before you go to sleep because it's going to keep you buzzed. And when people are not sleeping, they're not in good sleep-wake cycles, they're doing night shifts, those rhythms are thrown off. And so you can see that a person would get a basal elevated cortisol level. Now, the entity of adrenal fatigue is controversial. You'll see that Endocrine Society doesn't recognize it necessarily as a medical condition as opposed to something like adrenal failure or adrenal insufficiency. But what it does mean is that this person has a lifestyle that is not conducive to health, poor sleep, lots of stress, and that's going to result in a whole host of problems, blood pressure, sugar, effects on other hormone levels, and so that will result ultimately in low testosterone and can increase the risk of insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, hypertension we've already mentioned. And so managing stress levels, ensuring adequate rest and sleep become all the more important in those people. And unfortunately, oftentimes, there's not much you can do. If you're a shift worker, I can't say to you, okay, we'll stop working shifts.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a very difficult thing to manage ultimately.
Okay. A lot of our patients actually struggle with that.
I was actually just a follow-up question on that. I mean, I work in the emergency department myself, and so sleep, especially in the early days when I first started, that it became a real problem for me. Absolutely. And I didn't know how to manage it. And I think that there's a lot of people who either work shifts or, you know, maybe just have a stressful businesses or lives that they have to be up at all odd hours attending to work or just following up on emails and clients, whatever the case may be. And do you have any practical advice for someone who is in a position where they cannot get out of a messed up circadian rhythm or sleep cycle, but has to sort of try and manage it as best as they possibly can?
So I think a very important thing to address first is mental health, because it's one thing to be in the situation where you feel trapped in your job and you've got shift work and you can't get out of it. If you throw mental illness on top of that or depression or anxiety on top of that, it's a recipe for disaster. So the first thing becomes self-care in terms of mental well-being, whether that's meditation or prayer or debriefing or whatever it is that allows you to relax, exercise, you have to take care of that because you won't be able to say, okay, well, full emergency room, I'm going to go sleep now. So that thing you can't manage. So you have to do what you can. Mental health being one of them. Exercise being another. Healthy diet being another. Some advice, where it's possible, is to try and avoid doing 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, because those 2 week periods are enough to shift a circadian rhythm and then you're shifting back again. And so there's a constant changing. You will not get normalization of your rhythms. So where it's possible to do longer periods, one can. Oftentimes it's not possible. You know, a nurse won't necessarily work 4 to 6 weeks at night. She'll do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Then you have to make sure that the sleep that you do get, the rest that you do get, counts. It can't be that a person is coming home from work, is then on a device, is then on the TV, now is making lunch for the kids, turns around, she's got 2 hours to go that she can sleep before she has to go back to work. So you have to make that time count where you can. And then it's a challenge. It's a big challenge. There's no shortcuts, unfortunately.
How did you manage it? Because, I mean, all doctors kind of struggle with it maybe at some point. Maybe, you know, you at least I can say confidently, if you're a doctor that works in a department that requires them to be on call at night, you're at least going to be up all night at least once a week. And any doctor can attest to that.
It's difficult. I would like to be able to say that I was as zen then as I am now. But it's hard. And someone once gave me advice. He said, you have to be able to compartmentalize your life, meaning that there will be times where things are going to be hard and you have to prepare yourself for that. And you have to know
mentally.
That this is mentally, and you have to know that this is a short-term thing. So for me, for example, if I look at my registrar days, which I look back at now. And
yeah, registrar days is like specialization time.
And I think, how on earth did I survive that? The nights that we were doing, two nights a week, you're up. And I had a supportive wife. I had to make the sleep that I could get. I had to make a count. I had to make a concerted effort to get some sleep during the day to try and catch up. And just think to myself, this rotation will end. I'll get to a block where I won't have to do nights and compartmentalizing. It's easy when you're doing short rotations. If you're in a career where you are doing constant nights, that's where the mental health aspect is going to come into it again and the coping mechanisms.
I mean, I struggled with it in the beginning because we had that type of system where we do like a week where your unit covers the nights. So maybe you do three nights, four nights, sometimes as much as five nights, sometimes three in a row, then a break, then two nights. And we actually went to our head of department and we said, look, we can figure out a better way to do this where we don't actually all have to push 1 week of nights or, you know, be under that intense stress and then have a bit of, you know, because some people prefer that. Some people would like to just work a week of nights if they could get a week off. But we said, for our own well-being, that's not sustainable. And they actually changed it after we approached them. So I think that might be one practical
way. And we know that doing the odd night here or there is not going to affect you in terms of all these deleterious outcomes. It's when it's a prolonged thing. So if you're doing one call here, you know, this week, and then your next night shift is in 2 weeks' time and it's one night, that seems to be manageable. So we also know that people that are sleep deprived perform more poorly on skills tests like driving than many inebriated people do.
Yeah.
So it's been shown unequivocally. So these are things, and it's being recognized more and more. We've seen interns now working fewer hours at night than they used to historically because it's been shown how bad it is to work when you're so tired. And so I think where seniors are able to make a difference like that when they're approached by juniors in the profession should do so. You know, there's really no excusing it.
Let's talk a bit before, I think Vish probably has a few questions, but just a bit about the actually how important sleep is. And in as far as your knowledge, you know, maybe you can provide us with some insight and studies about the short, medium and long-term effects of sleep deprivation, whether that be once, you know, once a week or whether it be shift work. How does that actually affect the overall health of an individual?
Well, we've got to look at cognitive effects. We can look at physical effects as well, and the physical will be hormonal and others. So, I mean, cognitively, we know people that are sleep deprived perform poorer in tasks. You know, even one night of sleep deprivation, you know, if you've gone a night without sleeping, your mind is just foggy the next day. You amplify that by two or three nights and all the more so. So cognitively, there's no doubt that it's going to have a major impact on that because sleep is restorative and we need that to refresh ourselves. It's obvious, but it needs to be said. In the more long term, we do see an uncoupling of the circadian rhythms. And we are heavily dependent on these rhythms for normal hormonal secretion and optimal function. If your thyroid hormones are not being secreted at the appropriate times, if the cortisol is at the wrong time, that's going to be a major issue. Furthermore, when your body kind of feels that it's in a stressful situation, it starts to de-emphasize things that it sees as less important. So when someone's under severe stress, all of a sudden reproduction becomes less important. So you see that testosterone levels will fall in a man. Women will have menstrual irregularities as well because your body's not concerned with that. It's concerned with survival. And so you go into the state of feeling like you have to do whatever you can to survive. And that can also have issues with, again, mental well-being, breakdown in relationships. You see many people suffer in their family life as well because of this. Mm. Now, these are not things that are measurable. They'll do the studies and say, okay, what's the divorce rate in people that are shift workers? Mm. But it's not always measurable. No one's going to like enroll and say, well, I'm prepared to put my relationship under strain and enroll in the study, right?
Of course, yeah. Mm.
But these are things that we know will happen. Mm. And so on the physiological level, we do see the hormonal changes. We do see that hypertension increases. We do see insulin resistance becomes more of a problem with the resulting risk of type 2 diabetes.
Mm. And that's so, as a direct result of lack of sleep.
Absolutely. People that don't sleep well have a high risk of obesity as well. You know, people with sleep apnea that are not getting...
Mm. How does that work? Is that just a as a result of the cortisol that causes the more, central adiposity? Or is it because they're stressed or they're kind of more leaning towards...
No, it's multifactorial. Mm. It's multifactorial. The sleep deprivation itself will have a direct impact on hormonal secretion, but there will be increased cortisol and an adrenaline response, an exaggerated adrenaline response.
Mm.
And then with that, of course, will come unhealthy habits. So people tend to eat more sugar-sweetened food, high calorie-dense foods, which then increase the central adiposity, which then has an impact on cortisol levels and testosterone.
Yeah, I think, all of us can attest. Yeah. Post-call, you just want a nice, fat meal before you go to sleep.
The main thing also is testosterone is also going to cycle, it's a circadian cycle.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And poor sleep also affects testosterone, and that's the one we now are really serious about.
Mm.
So I know hormone replacement therapy has become now a lot of big popular thing. Mm. There's a lot of drug reps going around pushing HRT in women and in men. I think, I don't know why testosterone has this bad rep to it. A lot of people are hesitant to give TRT. What do you think of it?
So I think a lot of it comes from steroid use, steroid abuse. Yeah. That's where, most of our experience comes in.
Anabolic steroids.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So we know, for example, in the United States, there are more steroid users than there are type 1 diabetics or patients with HIV. It's
sure.
Rough. And... only
anabolic steroid use.
Anabolic steroid.
And that's across the board, men, women?
Predominantly men. These studies are done in men.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We do see in women, there's an increased use in women as well. And only a tiny minority of those people are elite athletes. Mm. So the vast majority of people using anabolic steroids are doing it purely for aesthetic reasons.
Mm.
And so that's informed a lot of our attitudes towards it. But there's no doubt that men do better when they have adequate testosterone levels.
Mm.
The question becomes, who is the ideal candidate for the testosterone therapy? Because... Mm. Fatigue is so common, so maybe the fatigue is testosterone, but maybe it's something else. And so a person that comes in complaining of fatigue should have testosterone levels done in the appropriate individual at the appropriate time. It's very important to time it. Doing a blood test at 8 o'clock in the morning versus midday will yield completely different results because testosterone levels are at their peak.
Mm. Peak.
Between 7 and 9 in the morning, let's say. And so there are many guidelines out there. I think there are a few important things. One, low testosterone level is not enough to say this person needs testosterone replacement therapy. It should be at least two levels, ideally separated by about 6 weeks.
Ideally.
Okay. In a young person with low testosterone, always warrants a bit of investigation as to why this is. Checking other hormones, FSH and LH from the pituitary that stimulate the testes to produce, because you don't want to miss something like a growth in the pituitary, hyperlactin levels or some other cause. So that's important. Something like Klinefelter syndrome, which is a very common condition underdiagnosed that needs to be looked for.
Mm.
So that should always be evaluated as well. And if the person has unequivocally low testosterone levels and no other obvious cause, that person should be considered for testosterone replacement therapy.
Mm.
And the form that it takes, that's open to discussion. But these are the people. We know as well that people that are obese do tend to have lower testosterone levels. Now, obesity can cause low testosterone, and similarly, low testosterone can predispose to obesity.
So it's a negative.
Mm. And they will affect each other like that as well. And so many of our diabetics, for example, that have low testosterone, there's one of two ways of looking at it. You could either say, well, giving testosterone will help the sugar and help the weight loss, or losing the weight will help the sugar and help the testosterone. And either one is correct. You could do either one. You can't neglect the sugar, but supplementing testosterone in a type 2 diabetic may actually improve outcomes. And so there is definitely a role for testosterone in men. You know, we don't look at postmenopausal women anymore and say, no hormones. We know that women that are suffering will benefit. It's the same thing with men. If a man has a low testosterone, he will benefit from being on therapy, provided he's been adequately assessed and worked up.
I see.
I just want to emphasize that point, because HRT in women, a lot of GPs will be hesitant to even give anything in a woman who has menopause, right? they'll just say, oh, you're going to get cervical, endometrial, or ovarian cancer. Just don't take it. It's so risky, right? Or it's going to cause cardiovascular risk or something. But there's a lot of studies saying that it reduces cardiovascular risk if you give it below the age of 60. There's like so many benefits of going on HRT, especially in women and in men. Like the lifestyle improvement is ridiculous.
I've had a woman tell me that I gave her life back because I gave her some HRT. This is a woman, she was an actress, and she was teary all the time. She couldn't perform anymore in terms of her career. And I evaluated her, we discussed it, we gave her HRT, and when I phoned her subsequently, she said, you know, you've changed my life. And the problem is, certainly when I was at medical school, there was a study called the Women's Health Initiative that came out. And this said that HRT in women must never be given. It looked like it was causing cancer, heart disease, all these things. It was terrible. So throughout medical school, we never gave HRT.
Yeah.
They went back and reviewed the data and saw it was misreported, and new evidence has come out, and now there are strong recommendations to give HRT to women. More and more, we're tuning into this for men as well, seeing the benefits of testosterone in men.
Yeah, and on that, the criteria for initiating TRT. So, you know, we obviously run the Gents Clinic where we see a lot of patients with this issue, and we're trying to formulate the best possible guidelines that we possibly can. One of the tools that we use is the Adams score, advanced, I'm forgetting now, androgen deficiency in aging men score. And basically, for those of you who haven't used our services or anything yet, that questionnaire is provided and patients will answer and it'll generate a score for them and basically tell them what their risk of hypogonadism or testosterone deficiency is. Some of the times we find that patients' testosterone levels are either borderline low or mid-range and they're having all the symptoms. And we may repeat their blood level, their hormonal levels at a later stage, and we still see a similar level, but they're still complaining about all the symptoms or a majority of those symptoms of low testosterone. Our thinking is that potentially earlier on in their life, they had a much higher normal range of testosterone, for what is normal for them, and they are lower than their normal reference, and therefore they are experiencing all of these symptoms of low testosterone because their baseline was just higher than an average male's was before. And so for these patients, we opt to start treating them and see if the effects of the testosterone actually take those symptoms away. Do you agree with this?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I mean, it is one particular approach to testosterone replacement therapy. The difficulty is, many men, or most men, are not having their testosterone levels done in the prime of life just out of curiosity. So by the time they're presenting, that's the only score that we've got. And the easy one is when the total is low and the free testosterone is low. That's the easy one. The difficulty is when it's more borderline, as you've said. The other issue is that the reference ranges for testosterone, particularly free testosterone, are so wide that if someone's got a testosterone in the lower range of normal, some of the assays being, say, 170, that's still normal. But someone can have a testosterone at 640, which is the upper limit of normal. That's a big difference. And so a person that's at 180, 190, yeah, strictly speaking, it's in the normal range, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's a bit of a deficiency relative for that person. And so the kind of advice that I give and what I look at is, if we've got a patient like that you've described, I'll look at anything else correctable. What is the lifestyle? Again, it's going to come down to lifestyle. Are they optimizing there? Eating well, sleeping as much as they can, or what's appropriate, exercising. And if they are, and there's nothing else, you know, the other hormonal profiles are good, and they've still got these symptoms, I think it's worth trying. You have the discussion with the patient. You say, these are the pros, these are the cons. We're going to target a testosterone level in the upper range of normal for you, and let's see how it goes. And bearing in mind, you have to give it a few months. Testosterone replacement therapy doesn't work like that. It takes time for all those nuclear changes to occur. And so they have to understand that they may need to give it 3 to 6 months, and then you see how they do. And I think that is reasonable, provided it's done in a safe way with the relevant monitoring.
And tell me, in terms of the regimens that you generally start patients on, we've got a wide variety of testosterone formulations that we can provide. Either the creams, we've got testosterone trochets, we've got IM injectables, so that's intramuscular injections. What would your approach be to a patient? Obviously, we consult with them what they most prefer, And then in terms of your starting regimens, do you use their current testosterone levels to gauge? Like if their testosterone is extremely low, would you start with a higher dose to start? Or do you have just a standard protocol that you give to your patients?
No, it's not standard. I think you have to individualize therapy. And that really is, you know, the way medicine is going more and more now, individualizing.
Mm.
You look at this patient, you look at his testosterone levels, symptoms, and then you see what's appropriate. A guy that weighs 130 kilograms might need a very different dose to someone who weighs 60 kilograms.
Of course.
So we'll look at that as well. In terms of the form that I give, I use either a gel or I try to use one of the shorter acting intramuscular injections. The main reason being the long acting intramuscular injections are convenient, cost aside, but very often they result in a superphysiological spike of the testosterone.
Yeah, yeah. We actually spoke about that.
Yeah, and the men become accustomed to that feeling so that even later on when their levels are still good, in the normal range, they feel low. Yeah. And so it becomes very difficult for this person to get adequate symptom control.
Mm.
Whereas some of the shorter acting ones, you can tailor much more. You can adjust both the dose as well as the frequency. Yeah. And so those are the guys that you can adjust. And there's moves towards using daily or twice weekly subcutaneous injections with an insulin injection as well.
It's that's what we're currently
doing. Yeah. So that's showing a lot of promise too for people. A daily gel, If a person has the discipline to do it, often provides a nice solution for them. But I often think about myself, if I was in a situation where I needed it, I probably wouldn't have the discipline to apply a daily gel. Yeah. Not in the way it needs to be done after shower in the morning, but some guys do it and they like it and they get good levels. The problem with the commercially available gels for some is that it's a fixed dose. You can't increase it. You're going to say two sachets, it's too much. You know, alternate day sachets, then you're not getting full 24-hour coverage, you know, you're dipping down. So that's where it becomes a bit of a challenge.
Mm.
There are some compounded products out there, though I've had bad experiences in the past where patients have come to me on a compounded formulation and we do their levels and there's no detectable hormone. So it comes down very much to the producer, the manufacturer of that. And so I tend to use the more commercially available ones. And where a person is not averse to using something like depotestosterone, that's testosterone cypionate, I will use that. But in those people, we have to monitor their hemoglobins. They're the ones that are prone to getting polycythemia, thickening of their blood. And so we want to make sure that that's not a problem for them. That's my own personal kind of preference, that particular way. But
and in terms of looking at their levels and adjusting dose, is that something that you do?
Absolutely. So I'll do both peak and trough levels. So trough levels will be the morning of the injection to see, are we dosing at an adequate frequency? And I'll do a peak level to see, are we giving too much or not enough, which will be at the midpoint of their injection. So if I'm giving something like cypionate, I'll do, say they're on a two-weekly injection, once every 2 weeks. At 1 week, I'll do a peak level. Pre-next injection, I'll do a trough level, and then I can see, bring it forward, extend it a little bit, adjust the dose up or adjust the dose down. And I'm targeting a level that is always in the normal range. So even that trough level must be in the normal range. Because if a person is hitting a peak above in the superphysiological range and then a trough below normal, they're going to be miserable. There's no symptom control there. So they should always be in the normal range. And something like a long-acting injectable like Nabido, there we would typically do trough levels to make sure that the duration of dosing is adequate. Not much you can do about dose adjusting because it is that single ampule. So that's kind of my approach to testing. But I think they must be followed up and they must be tested.
Also, a higher frequency, patients really love those ones where they feel better control. Like longer acting libido stuff, everyone complains about that.
Yeah, and I remember being a fellow, we only had access to testosterone cypionate, which was fine, but we could only give it once a month. Yeah. And for most men, once a month cypionate is just not enough.
Yeah.
So for a week or 2 weeks, you'll feel good, and then it dips down. And so what you end up doing is writing up doses that are too high. So they'll still peak, and they'll still fall down quickly, and it's not ideal.
Yeah. Those patients also end up with more side effects, obviously with acne, mood changes that were probably not there even before.
Yeah, definitely.
With the much more great changes in the testosterone levels.
And often, you know, these are the patients that the partners will have something to say about as well. You know, if you're going to be giving guy extremely high testosterone levels, you're going to be amping him up. And the partner might not be so keen. So that's always something to bear in mind.
Of course.
There's often a wife or girlfriend behind this.
Yes.
Yeah. I think a forum like this is important because a lot of men are, you know, we always say it's the door on the handle kind of question. As they're leaving and they put the door on the handle, oh, doc, just one other thing.
It's always a lot of men,
particularly when it's around libido, when it's around performance, erectile dysfunction. We don't typically say testosterone deficiency is a major cause of erectile dysfunction, but in many men it can be, right? Mm. And it's something to have a discussion around with them. And these are such sensitive issues, particularly, you know, in South Africa, it's been my experience that a man's virility is something that's treasured. Yeah. And if you question that, it's terrible. Mm. And so people are reluctant to speak about it. And you have to draw out of them a little bit more and more with, you know, the social media kind of emphasis that's being placed on. People are open to it.
Mm.
But it's important to discuss it and to have that discussion and sometimes raise it with your patients. You've got an older gentleman who's obese and diabetic. Say to him, you know, how are your energy levels? What's your libido like? What's any erectile dysfunction?
Of course. Of course. Yeah. I mean, this is probably very relevant to you, Vish, because you probably seeing a lot of, for you, a lot of patients will come to you and say, we got referred. This is our problem. You're the guy that's going to help us. Whereas with Vish, he's in urology and patients will say, you know, it's not working as like it used to and this and that. So does your sort of protocols in terms of management of these conditions differ? Do you refer straight to endocrine or do you try and manage it yourself if you can?
So I think Brad as well would say in private, I think the urologists also do treat these patients as well.
With TRT as well, yeah.
It's like, if a patient approaches the endocrinologist first, they will keep that patient. If the urologist sees them first, they'll keep that patient. I think the other thing to keep in mind as well with older patients, like PSA screening and abnormal prostate digital rectal examination.
Testosterone is a risk for prostate.
I think just on that, it's important to state that testosterone replacement therapy does not increase the risk of de novo prostate cancer. So it's not going to cause a cancer out of the blue, but it will nurture pre-existing cancer.
So baseline PSA. Well, do you advise all your patients or just a specific age range to get the PSA?
Generally age range.
So what I was telling you guys, So I mean, obviously family history, things like that obviously or will trigger you to do it at an earlier age. But otherwise, I mean, the normal screening routine from the appropriate age range that we mentioned. I think also with
the same protocols that Brad uses, you guys use the exact same.
So you know, again, in state, all of the products are not available. Mm. We also use test subunit. At Simja, we can use 100 milligrams weekly. It's just often the patients don't actually end up getting their injections, or they always run out of stock, or they'll sell them. Oh, you can actually only get it once every 2 weeks or once every month.
So the dosing becomes a problem.
It's actually even worse because for 1 month they might get it, correct? And then the next month they might get it once in the month.
And that, so, I mean, that has huge consequences in terms of messing up their entire HPA axis. If they can't get that regular dose,
I mean, sometimes it's something just as simple as transport to the hospital to get the injection.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we used to encounter a lot as well. And as you said, it will interfere with the axis. If a patient has been on testosterone replacement therapy for a prolonged period, we do expect the pituitary to be somewhat suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a variable amount of time for it to wake up again, if it's going to. And so if someone's been on treatment and now he's not, and then he's getting only intermittent, there isn't the opportunity for the body's natural mechanisms to wake up again, or maybe they can't. And he's not getting it appropriately in terms of a dosing schedule, so he's really getting the worst of both worlds in that case.
Mm. Just another question with regards to, I suppose, the differences between government and private. I'm assuming you worked for a bit as an endocrinologist in government, so you understand some of the challenges he's speaking about. Naseem works in primary healthcare, and I'm sure in government you weren't getting as many referrals for potential TRT as you are now in private. Do you think that's because of lack of education at a specific socioeconomic level? Or do you feel like the referral system, like GPs are more aware of the issue and they'll refer to an endocrinologist? Or do you think that there's just either primary healthcare physicians are not picking it up and referring to you, or patients don't know or are not really, you know, divulging enough information that would lead a primary healthcare physician to make that diagnosis and then refer?
I think it's all along the way. If you consider the average person in private who's coming in and requesting testosterone testing to be done, where's he received the information to ask that question?
Yeah.
So that's usually social media.
Yeah.
So if a guy in the community out there doesn't have access to internet or isn't social media savvy, he's not getting that message. So he doesn't know to ask the question.
Yeah.
The second issue is oftentimes people come in, they're presenting to their local clinic. The average, let's say, nurse working in the local clinic is not thinking about testosterone.
Hmm.
She's got 300 people to see today, some of which have tuberculosis or HIV or pneumonia or gastro, whatever it is, and testosterone is not necessarily on her mind. I think, again, in the communities out there, often this is also a mark of shame if a man comes in and says, my manhood is not what it should be. So that's the challenge over there. What we encountered, I think, when I was at Joburg Gen, what I saw a lot of, the people that were getting testosterone had some kind of underlying diagnosis like Klinefelter syndrome or hyperpituitarism. They weren't being picked up for other things. So I can't think of someone that came to me and was there purely for testosterone replacement therapy.
Interesting.
And they don't get through. And I've always said that about the government sector. People with, let's say, soft complaints don't get through to the endocrinologists. Yeah. You're shielded.
So, I mean, patients that we've also sent through a bilateral orchidectomy, young kids, I mean, previous torsion, you know, torsion on the other side or atrophic testicle. So it's always the patient who actually has no testosterone, or the testosterone that is produced is from the adrenal, which is not sufficient.
And I think you're going to get
what percentage would you say of the adrenal provides testosterone versus the testicle?
In men, it's minimal.
Yeah,
so DHEA and androstenedione, which are two adrenal androgens, do get converted to testosterone. They're weak androgens. But we
as a percentage? Of the total?
Less than like one.
We're to the extent that if you look at the standard endocrine literature, it doesn't really advocate for DHEA and androstenedione replacement, okay, well, DHEA more, because we're not even sure of the major role that it plays in men. Some people are looking at it in terms of its role in sexual health, but there are no double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trials evaluating this, so the data is not ideal at this stage. DHEA has more of a role to play in women, but in men it's questionable. So I see many men coming on the DHEA, and then we say, well, let's withdraw it and see if it makes a difference. And many times it doesn't. So I'm not convinced of its role at this stage in that, even in patients with adrenal failure, if a gentleman has enough testosterone there, that's generally doing what it needs to do for him.
Like, I think in women, DHEA is a big thing. Like, I think women have like 1% of testosterone as men have, right? It's crazy. And also, like, HRT in women is a bit difficult, like, because it's like three hormones. It's testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone that you now have to monitor, right? And like sexual libido, that kind of stuff in women, it's testosterone that matters in that situation. So if a woman has like low libido as they get older, now you need to think about testosterone, not just the normal HRT, which is estrogen and progesterone.
And we do know that in women, even in their reproductive years, DHEA quantitatively is the most important androgen. Qualitatively, testosterone is more so, and that's going to be ovarian. But when a woman goes through menopause, so now that DHEA is really her only source of androgen. And so current guidelines don't necessarily recommend DHEA as a supplementation in HRT for women. Testosterone, there's a bit more of a question around. There's growing enthusiasm for its use in women, but it needs to be very carefully done. The last thing you want to do is, you know, cause a beard to grow in her. But there is a growing body of work looking at that as well. And it is a bit more complex. Also, many women, they may not even need the progesterone, assuming that there's no intact uterus. If she's got a uterus, obviously she has to be on the progesterone to protect from endometrial cancer. But if she doesn't, so current guidelines would say the estrogen. And then depending on sense of well-being, vitality, libido, you might look to add an androgen in that case then.
Like, just going back on that topic of men coming for TRT, like, I think also it's like the attitude of doctors to testosterone. Like, a lot of people would say, it's just your age. Men will come with erectile dysfunction. They'll find they might obviously know they have low testosterone, but it's like, it's natural. It's a natural thing to happen. But then once you put the patient back on testosterone replacement therapy, the lifestyle improvement is so crazy that it's something that they should be doing, you know?
It's interesting because it's crept into the kind of collective consciousness that testosterone levels decline appreciably with age as a norm. And that's not true. There are actually no data set to support that. It's about a 1% reduction per year. How clinically significant that is will vary from person to person. It also depends on sex hormone binding, globulin, those kinds of things. So to say to a man who's 60, because the latest meta-analyses show that after age 65 or 70, testosterone reduction are more as a result of comorbid illnesses, meaning that this is not a norm for this guy. If he's got a low testosterone, he would benefit from therapy, and he needs to be investigated why it is like that. So to just brush it off to age and say, nah, it's age-related decline, it's not appropriate.
But even if it is age-related decline, don't you think that some patients still deserve TRT?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I said, a man will do well when he's on testosterone. And you see the testosterone trials, which are the large group of tests that were done, the trials, they didn't show necessarily outcomes benefit in terms of cardiovascular, but they did show improvement in 6-minute walking time, vitality, general well-being. So maybe we can't measure it as a cardiac outcome, but it improves his quality of life.
Mm.
And that's for sure. So I think these men should be given the benefit of the doubt.
It's even worse if a patient has like erectile dysfunction and other comorbidities like hypertension, diabetes, because they'll just blame the erectile dysfunction on those hypertension. Mm. They'll say, control your hypertension, control your sugar, then your erection will come back.
Mm. Also with those age groups, I mean, also with a lot of the patients that we see, male pattern baldness, you're using finasteride, or even for BPH patients, you're using finasteride or dutasteride. Those also now cause low testosterone as well. Mm. So those things also need to be looked at if patients are on certain medications, which is common for that age group
and
as
I
well.
Absolutely. And the other thing, I mean, was the topic of the discussion. We haven't really discussed it, but obesity in and of itself is going to be a cause of low testosterone, you know, and you've got aromatization of testosterone to estrogen, which can then further lower testosterone
I think explain that a bit more in detail for our audience who is not of the medical community.
So
aromatization. And
so, you know, for the longest time, we thought that fat mass is inert. You know, it's just your subcutaneous schmaltz, as we say, and it doesn't do anything. But we know that fat, and in particular visceral fat, is metabolically very active. It secretes a whole host of chemokines, or adipokines, as we call them, which are inflammatory mediators. But an additional function of fat is to convert testosterone to estrogen, what we call aromatization. And so the more visceral fat a man has, the greater the aromatization will occur. And that estrogen that's being produced will now have a negative feedback in terms of further testosterone production. It will also alter sex hormone binding globulin levels. Sex hormone binding globulin is a carrier protein. So we know when we look at testosterone levels, we look at total testosterone. And then we look, which is a combination of dissolved free testosterone in the blood and testosterone bound to this carrier molecule. And so it's thought that the free testosterone is what's biologically available to stimulate the receptor. If there's an increase in sex hormone binding globulin, more of that dissolved testosterone binds to it. And so you may have a normal or even high total testosterone, but a low free testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why more and more we're looking at the free testosterone as an important mark of when to treat and not treat.
So with regards to sex hormone binding globulin, right, how can a man reduce his? Because essentially you'd want to reduce your amount of SHBG so that you have more free testosterone. So is there something that you could do?
In theory, that's a good premise, but in practice, what we know with endocrine systems is that the body has a way of self-correcting. So as the sex hormone binding globulin levels fall and free testosterone increases, the body will then start lowering total testosterone so that the free will then fall into the normal range again for that person.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And that's why many of these products, there are many supplements out there that are thought to displace testosterone off sex hormone binding globulin and increase free testosterone. Many of them will only be a short-term cure because long-term, the body will then just reconfigure.
Mm.
And so the best way to optimize sex hormone binding globulin is healthy lifestyle. Diet, exercise, lose the weight. That's the best way. Certain medications can do it. Certain other disease states like liver failure or liver dysfunction can do it. But obviously, you want to avoid all those things. And so lifestyle becomes the cornerstone of therapy for it.
Like, I've seen some GIT clinics give like Anava, which has like DHT. Because DHT has like a high affinity to SHBG, just to lower SHBG.
Yeah. So when you look at anabolic steroid use, and I mean it's not just some guy in the gym injecting testosterone cypionate. These are highly scientific things. You know, they've got their cycles that they do. It's quite impressive when you actually look into it. It's completely unsafe, but it's very impressive. and they know exactly what this particular, is this more androgenic? Is it more anabolic? What's its affinity to DHT? What's its affinity to sex hormone binding globulin? And they'll combine these agents together to give them the ultimate stack to accomplish what they're trying to achieve at that time, whether it's muscle growth or lean tissue maintenance at the expense of fat burning. And so a lot of these agents are used for those kinds of things.
Mm.
And you won't learn about that in the general endocrinology or general urology. You have to go out there.
You have to listen to the guys talk about it.
To get into the dirty world of the internet.
Or just listen to them chat, because it's actually fascinating when you hear the layman talk about stuff that we studied in medical school for years and rehashed and wrote exams about.
Bro,
and
these science.
Bro science is powerful.
But I mean, it's interesting because I remember starting off in private and these guys coming to me and telling me some of the stuff that they'd been using, and you have to kind of
what's that?
Yeah, you have to somehow get to look at your formula to see what the medication is. You know, or how do you spell that? And then
funny enough, your mentor, he actually, when he was giving us a tut and we were talking just about endocrine and we were asking him, what's the most common thing now that you've moved to private? He had just come back to state. He had started in private and he was just in private and then he came back to state. He said, the reason why I came back is because I was getting bored of guys walking into my office with a duffel bag full of steroids, throwing it on the table and saying, this is what I'm using, keep me alive, kind of thing. Is it that common?
Look, I don't have it like that, but it is extremely common out there.
Sure.
You know, men that are using or have used, I don't personally facilitate the use of it. I don't think that it's a healthy thing to do, but it is very common out there.
So if a patient, and this is something we've discussed as well, if a patient were to come to you and say, look, I'm going to use it either way, and this is what I'm planning to use. Do you have any advice for me? Can you monitor my bloods? Can you help me do it effectively? Our theory is that, look, you know, based on our ethical principles, we believe that somebody's going to do it. Like, for example, you know, there's a debate whether should a clinic give an IV drug user a safe needle so that it prevents them from potentially getting HIV or Hep C or other illnesses that come with the use of unsafe IV drug use and potentially maybe help them get over it through the intervention that they'll come to the clinic every month and get the safe needle. Do you think that there's room for us to also say ethically, we do have a responsibility to take care of these patients because we know that they could potentially do serious more harm if we don't help them?
It's a difficult question, you know, and it's going to come down ultimately to personal ethics.
Mm.
Because you hear both sides of the argument are compelling. On the one hand, you've taken an oath, first do no harm. On the other hand, these drugs will do harm, even if you're monitoring them. Now, you could say, yes, we're going to keep your hemoglobin here and your HDL there. But ultimately, when you look at the outcomes data, there is harm to anabolic steroid use.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a hard question. You know, and this is really why there's so much controversy around safe needle programs as well. Because on the one hand, the person's going to do it anyway. But does that mean it's your responsibility to make sure it's a safe way? It's a personal ethical question, I think, you know, and not for me to force my ethics onto anyone else. I know what I do, but I'm not going to fault someone who decides to do the opposite to what I do.
But you do help clean them up.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if someone comes to me and the guy said to me, now, look, I'm off this or I want to come off it, but I'm worried about crashing my testosterone, I'm going to give him the stuff that I can to support it.
So yeah, just talking about that then, I think so. I mean, we've seen a lot of patients as well, like you start them on a, you know, a normal dose of HRT, which should get them to normal levels. Some patients obviously take more than they need and obviously develop now gynecomastia and things like that. Obviously, the estrogen levels are high. Do you routinely prescribe like a SERM, like a Clomid or Tamoxifen?
Well, and just define that for the viewers. What are those medications that you're talking about?
So like essentially like an estrogen receptor blocker, modulator.
To essentially reduce the estrogen that's been converted from the excess testosterone.
Yeah. So, you know, if a person is on, let's say is on a therapeutic dose of the testosterone, so levels where you want them, but still is aromatizing and has more estrogen than is. So there you would look to, I would use something like tamoxifen, which is a selective estrogen receptor modulator. Sometimes some people use aromatase inhibitors as well. Letrozole or anastrozole, very low dose, once or twice a week. Where the testosterone levels are too high, I would try to bring down those levels first as a primary intervention, but sometimes you can't, and then I think that is an intervention. Never like to treat a side effect that you've created with another medication.
And concurrently, you're giving them
Those people that want to try to come off it altogether, then I would support with something like Clomid or HCG, try to get their access going again, but I think that's it.
Then also with patients that, say, for example, borderline or lowish testosterone, but want to maintain fertility, would you then use HCG?
And I think before you answer that, just so that the viewers understand that TRT or testosterone replacement therapy, maybe Vish, you can explain like how the infertility works, like with excess levels of testosterone.
So essentially excess levels of testosterone or exogenous, actually, testosterone, it causes a negative feedback loop with all your hormonal levels, essentially. So what it does is, essentially, it tells your brain or your pituitary to stop producing gonadotropin-releasing hormone.
And that is?
So essentially, that targets now your body to produce testosterone. So it basically produces LH, which is luteinizing hormone, and FSH, which is follicular stimulating hormone. So those essentially act on your testes. One is to produce testosterone, and one is
that's the LH,
and one is obviously to force spermatogenesis, which is your FSH.
Yeah, to create
essentially, if that causes a negative feedback loop,
fertility, yeah,
that will obviously
so it shuts down the factory. Yeah, basically shuts down the factory, so infertility and your own natural production of testosterone.
And that's what will cause testicular atrophy or shrinkage in gents as well, because the supporting structures in the testes are stimulated by FSH. And so if there's a young man who's still desiring fertility or a family, then giving him testosterone is not the optimal, it's not the ideal agent. There are some studies that have been done looking at intratesticular testosterone levels and testosterone only, but generally it's not going to work. And so there we would consider medication like clomiphene, Clomid, which is it's an estrogen-like molecule, and it stimulates at a pituitary level, stimulates the production of FSH and LH. So it allows your body to naturally produce testosterone and sperm. It is off-label use in South Africa for men, but it's used quite effectively. The other one is HCG. HCG, of course, is the hormone that women produce when they're pregnant, and that's what keeps the fetus, the embryo, developing. And it's the basis for the pregnancy test. But when we use it, it also stimulates FSH and LH production. And so you can kind of keep the natural axis going that way. And with the FSH, will promote spermatogenesis, and the supporting structures will be nurtured as well.
So I also want to ask, like, going back on obesity, there's like, and we see how excess fat causes aromatization and all of this. There's a strong combination that people are taking. It's TRT and Ozempic. These guys love being on these two. What do you think of Ozempic?
Ozempic is a fantastic drug when used in the appropriate setting.
What's the appropriate setting?
Okay, so firstly, type 2 diabetes. I think we have to say that because that's the registration in South Africa. That's what the drug was developed for. So it's a very effective lower of blood sugar, and it's got a number of benefits, cardiovascular, renal, stroke. So it's a great drug. And then, of course, there's the weight loss as a benefit. Overseas, it's registered under the trade name Wegovy. It's the same compound, semaglutide. And it's a very effective weight loss molecule. And so in South Africa, it's being used off-label for weight loss. And it can affect very good weight loss. So if a person is doing everything that he or she can to lose the weight and is still struggling, that's a good time to try the drug. The problem is many people have 1 or 2 kilos to lose, and they're going to try Ozempic. And of course, that takes away from the diabetics. Or they are not optimizing their lifestyles. And this will, on the one hand, mitigate the full benefit of the drug. And on the other hand, the drug is not a replacement for it, because at some point you might want to come off of it. At a bariatric dose of 2.4 milligrams a week, you're looking at close to 5,000 rand a month, and the medical aids won't pay for that. It's very naive to think that a person is going to be able to pay 5,000 rand a month for the rest of his or her life if he's starting this drug at 40 years old. So at some point, a person is going to need to consider coming off of it. So it is a good drug, and it does work. But you have to have a long discussion with the patient about how long do they want to be on it, what are their expectations. A third of people will have no response. A third of people will have a good response, and a third of people have some response. It's not been my experience that a third will have no response. But does the some response justify the cost? So these are questions, you know, a discussion to have. It's a good drug. It really is. I can't sit here and say, no, it shouldn't be on it. But it needs to be done correctly, because there is a concern of sarcopenia, lean muscle loss with it. You get the so-called Ozempic face if it's too rapid. So these are all conversations to have, and maybe a more slow up titration or twice a week of a lower dose. These are all strategies being employed. None of them are recommended yet, but these are things that people are doing to look at it. And I think with tirzepatide, which is probably going to be launched here very shortly, the GLP-1, GIP, dual receptor analog, that's even more effective than Ozempic, all the more so we'll have to have these discussions with patients.
Like we see a lot of patients like wanting to jump on it, and I like that you started with lifestyle modification. Like, first start with diet, exercise, and then you build up to start with Ozempic as a, like a last resort sort of thing, right? But what do you think about like diabetes and that kind of stuff? Like, how do patients like what do you tell patients about trying to lose weight, managing diabetes?
It's very difficult, because if you look at type 2 diabetes as a disease, the situation the patient is in is because of this adverse lifestyle that they've had. And you've got to retrain all that. You've got to say, whereas before there was indiscipline, now you need to have discipline. So there's a whole mindset that has to shift over here, and it may need a psychologist or something, but you still have to have the discussion. So the first thing to have with them is a conversation about what are your goals in terms of weight loss? Why do we want you to lose the weight loss? And we give them all the benefits of the weight loss. How much? Well, 7 to 10% reduction in body weight is going to give you cardiovascular benefit. So if someone weighs 130 kilograms, that person thinking, I'm going to get down to my ideal BMI, is ludicrous. It's not going to happen. Some of these people, I had one person who weighed 150 kilograms. He said the last time he weighed 100 kilograms was when he was 18 and he was now 50-something. Mm. So you have to also say, what is your target? 70, 10% reduction is a good place to start. Then you have a discussion about how do you lose weight, about having a calorie deficit, what kind of exercise to do, you know, zone, whether it's zone 2 cardio or high-intensity interval training, but get active, minimum 150 minutes a week. Mm. Calorie restriction. And then you say, set yourself 7 to 10% reduction body weight. And then readjust your target once you get there. And slowly work your way down like that. Don't say you're going to lose 70 kilograms because you're destined to fail in that regard. And the person needs to understand, as you lose more weight, so further weight loss becomes more difficult. It's okay. We can adjust. We can change our strategies. You'll change your exercise. We'll do something different from the diet. And you just support them through that. And it needs to be a discussion had from the outset.
So like also the I see muscle also as like an endocrine organ, right? It has a lot of basal metabolic rate. It also helps you lose fat as well, right? So I also see a lot of patients also using thyroxine as a weight loss medication. What do you think of that?
It makes about as much sense as losing weight by removing vital organs to take it with thyroxine, right? Because ultimately, you're putting yourself at risk of hypertension, cardiac arrhythmias, osteoporosis, and further glucose, dysglycemia as well as potentiating effects of adrenaline. And it's not a sustainable thing to do that. So there are many people that will use it. And again, anabolic
bodybuilders
will use it, will use the thyroid to cut. But it's not a sustainable long-term thing. It's not healthy to do. It was actually, there's a very popular weight loss supplement called The Secret that is sold over the counter as a herbal or a natural thing. And it was actually found to have T4, T3, a diuretic and subutrinine. So you have to be careful with these things. It is in there because it does work, but it's not a good idea to use that as a weight loss product.
Awesome. Awesome. Vish, any last questions, any thoughts?
I think it was very informative.
I really enjoyed this conversation, Dr. Mowitz. We often have these conversations with each other, and we just read the studies. We haven't written any of the exams you have, but this is something.
That's the truth. You don't have to, and you guys are doing a good job at
this. This is something we are genuinely very interested. I think all of us, after listening to you and hearing this discussion, may want to become endocrinologists and specifically advocate for TRT because we think it's so important in our society and something that's overlooked. So thank you so much for joining us on this episode, and we hope to have you back again to talk more about the world of endocrinology. And thank you guys for supporting us and watching another episode of ours. Please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to The Real Network and to our podcast, Let's Talk Man. This has been another episode with me, Dr. Sohail Essa, signing off.
Dr. Vishen Naidu.
Dr. Naseem Sharif.
Dr. Brad Mowitz.
Thank you. See you guys next week.